In the Moment is supported by the South Dakota Humanities Council, presenting the South Dakota Festival of Books, September 26th to 28th in Spearfish.
When parents are frustrated with public schools, they sometimes pull their kids and seek other pathways for learning. From SDPB, today is Tuesday, September 9th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, we discuss the politics and policy of ESAs, from education savings accounts in South Dakota to empowerment scholarship accounts in Arizona. Programs across the nation are redefining what education reform looks like. The biggest opportunity for micro schools seems to be in areas where public schools are already underfunded. We'll talk about accountability and rigor and safety throughout this hour. Plus, today's Teacher Talk explores the brain science of learning, and the Teacher Talk educators get a national nod to the work they do right here in South Dakota. That's coming a bit later in the hour. We are broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're In the Moment. News is first.
Politics and Public Policy Reporting is supported by the Center for Western Studies at Augustana University.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The September issue of Harper's Magazine features the changing nature of education in America. Journalist Chandler Fritz became a micro school vendor in Arizona to explore the state's Empowering Scholarship Account program, otherwise known as ESAs. We'll talk to him in a moment. But first, South Dakota had its own ESA conversation earlier this year. Here at home, ESA stands for Education Savings Account. Before we get the nationwide update, we invited SDPB's CJ Keene to provide a reminder of the debate in state. You're all over the state right now doing some reporting, but before we look ahead to what you've got going, I want to remind listeners of something that happened last year in Governor Kristi Noem's, it seems like 10 years ago, right? But it was really only 2024 in her final budget proposal, or her budget address, where she said she was going to set aside $4 million in ongoing funding for what are known as education savings accounts. And we are still talking about it, even though the bill never made it out of the House. So help listeners understand a little bit about why it's such an issue that is an ongoing conversation. But let's start with helping us understand what education savings accounts, South Dakota style, actually are.
The thing about education savings accounts, or ESAs, is that they are, first of all, controversial inside the Capitol, even among the Republican base. And alongside that is a use of taxpayer funds to bring different students who might not financially be able to afford a private primary and secondary education to a perhaps religious or private institution, alternative education, as it were. Mm-hmm. And this was, of course, a battle in the legislative session. And it continues to be a talking point in the legislative off season as, you know, South Dakota continues to tangle with how are we going to address this moving forward, if we are going to address this moving forward. And, of course, the public school lobby kind of use this as just another form of getting vouchers, taxpayer-funded vouchers, in front of lawmakers once again.
All right, so House Bill 1020 was introduced by Representative Odenbach, and that kind of offered an outline for how that program might work. Again, it did not make it out of committee. What's the idea here? What's the hope? What's the problem that this is supposedly a response to?
So one of the more potent arguments in favor of ESAs is that it gives people an opportunity who might not be able to, say, afford a parochial education or an alternative education to get in there. I remember the lawmaker who said this exactly escapes me, but it's like, we're not going to the Sioux Falls Country Club to get students involved in this program. At the same time, though, many are viewing this as, why can't we fix our public education system using the money that we would be diverting outside of the public education system to fund this?
How much of this was driven by homeschool parents? When we talk about, you know, all, you know, faith-based private schools, micro schools, which may or may not be faith-based, and then alternative instruction, which could include homeschooling, how much of the homeschooling lobby was behind this, is behind ESAs?
Oh, there positively was a homeschooling force involved in this. And it makes sense because it would some of the proposals would also support homeschooling families. That is not a universal opinion. A recent story that I worked on with FairSD, Fair South Dakota, Families for Alternative Instruction Rights in South Dakota, they voiced their opposition to this. So even among who you would presume as the base of support for this proposal is still some people who think that this would not be a wise decision to pass in the state.
What's the opposition from the folks who want to promote homeschooling and alternative education but don't think this is the right way, that $3,000 for families is not the right way to do it? What are they saying the reason why is?
Right. So I spoke with the group's president, Lisa Fisher, and she says, follow the money. Once you accept that money, first of all, think of the reasons why you might choose to go to a homeschool. You don't like what's being taught. There's too much testing. There's too much teaching to testing. Whatever that reason might be, if you accept money from the government, her logic is that in turn, a lot of those government mandates would very quickly follow you into your home. Along with that, there is also, she describes herself as a fiscal conservative. Really, it's a complicated matter for her, and I think she put a lot of thought into why she would want to come out, her organization would want to come out against these. But the quote that I have in front of me here is, within one or two legislative sessions, more regulations are being put on those that take those money, and even those that choose not to take the money. So it boils down to an academic freedom for somebody in her position to be able to continue whatever reason brought a homeschool family to make that decision.
Sure. All right. What do you see happening here in the non-session summer time frame? What are you hearing might happen next in an upcoming session? Or is this the idea of education savings accounts dead?
I don't think it's safe to say that this is dead. I think that there's absolutely, among lawmakers at least, some degree of an appetite to continue this battle. But as we've seen, it's not universally supported, even among who you'd consider the base, very strongly opposed in the public school lobby. So if this comes back, it's definitely going to be yet another fight for this.
That's SDPB's CJ Keene. After the break, Chandler Fritz describes the education landscape in Arizona, where their ESAs have changed the nature of public education. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The September issue of Harper's Magazine features a report on micro schools in Arizona. Journalist Chandler Fritz says, depending on whom you talk to, Arizona's ESA program is, quote, either a guiding light for education reform or the beginning of the end of American public education. We connected to discuss the politics and policy behind these empowerment scholarship accounts. And I'm not sure how much you know about politics in South Dakota, but we had an ESA piece of legislation that failed to get out of committee last legislative session earlier this year. Our ESA acronym stood for Education Savings Accounts, and we had a lot of debate about how this might work, how it, what need is it trying to respond to, what parents were asking for, what educators said the problems might be. So when I saw your article in Harper's about the program in Arizona, it was of high interest. So I think a lot of people are tuned into the idea. Tell me how you became interested in the Empowerment Scholarship Account program in Arizona.
Yes, and I appreciate you specifying the different names, although they all do kind of fall under the umbrella of ESA, the acronym ESA, and each state is fancies themselves clever in how they use that acronym to empower parents and families.
Yeah.
The Arizona ESA program was the first to do what's called a universal program. So it's available to any student in the state, regardless of income, family background, the factors that ordinarily limit or voucher programs in other states. I became interested in the program, really for two reasons. One, as a journalist, I was interested in the program because students were, for all intents and purposes, disappearing into it. The state was giving their family money, but it was keeping no record of how they were spending the money, where they were spending it, and most importantly, what the kids were learning at their schools where the money was being spent at. And so as a journalist, I was interested in finding those kids and those families that had more or less disappeared into the program and learning what was happening. As a teacher, I was teaching in Arizona at the time. I was interested in the program because, well, I knew it had a certain romantic sensibility to it, which was that here is a way to resurrect the traditional American schoolhouse, where you would just have a handful of students in a room, and you wouldn't have any administrative pressures, you wouldn't have any standardized testing pressures. It would just be kind of for the pure love of learning. And I'm not gonna lie, there was a certain romantic attraction to that, and I wanted to know how much of that was fantasy versus how much was myth. And so I went in both as a journalist interested in understanding how public funds were being spent in the system, and then as a teacher, trying to see if this was a window into a different way of teaching, maybe even a more attractive way of teaching.
Yeah, and I think the you get deeper in the article, and this is so important to the philosophy behind it, is really a moral one. It's not because the school was failing, as you mentioned. It's not a response to that necessarily. It is the idea that parents should have the right to educate their children, as I think at one point you said God and George Washington, or Jesus and George Washington, intended. tell me about the moral underpinnings of this movement that you discovered.
What makes ESA very different is that there's been a paradigm shift in language. We've previously spoken about choice in education as being school choice. And I mentioned in the article, this was always kind of an imperfect banner, because school choice included both those who I would say tend to be more liberal education reformers who were interested in experimenting with the way we do public education, largely through charter schools. Charter schools were, in many states, a bipartisan consensus brought charter schools into existence, with many Democratic politicians, especially in urban areas, being champions, early champions of charter schools. So school choice included the charter school movement, but it also has always included a conservative religious education reform movement, which goes way back into the 19th century with Catholic schools, or with Catholic priests in New York City advocating for public education to, for public dollars to be used to start Catholic schools. That movement has obviously continued up until this day, and it too has fallen under the school choice banner. With ESA, what these advocates are calling the movement now is parent choice or parental choice, which is to say that the underpinning for this movement, the philosophy for this movement, is that public education should be about empowering parents. And I had found in writing this piece how easily it seems many of ESA's advocates have forgot about empowering students, despite the names of the programs. The moral philosophy was really the purpose of the program is to empower parents and empower families.
Yeah. When you're interviewing people and talking to people in a micro school about their experiences in public school, there is a sense of woundedness. Many of them have been in a classroom where they didn't fit in or where they didn't feel comfortable. What did you notice about the experience of public school, which maybe pushed some people to the micro school format or a homeschooling format?
Yeah, there's two reactions. The one from the students was students were really frustrated by their public school experience. I have a student that I write about at length in the piece who is kind of the classic enigma in public schools. He's dyslexic, he learns best with his hands. And he had been frustrated by feeling kind of confined and feeling like there wasn't a place for him in public schools today. And their experiences, when they recount them, they often recount them with a good sense of humor, in that they feel that ESA has rescued them from what was really a boring and an education that did not see them as skilled or valuable members in a classroom. Parents, on the other hand, it was interesting to hear their high school experiences recounted. They held a lot of grievance towards bad teachers, towards school systems that held them back. And they would even, visibly, you could see this, them seething with frustration. And so I do think, this is a small sample size, only 8 students in my class, but I do think a driving force behind ESA are a generation of parents who came up in the No Kid Left Behind era, who came up in an era of schooling where standardized testing really got notched up a level in a way it hadn't before, and who hold a grievance towards public schools for those specific ways that they see it failed them.
Yeah. Let's tell people about your class, because as part of the reporting, you go in as a teacher and invite kids around the circle to talk about To Kill a Mockingbird. Tell me a little bit about how you became a micro school vendor.
Yeah, vendor is an important word to know. So kind of perversely, they're not called teachers, they're called vendors in the system, which I suppose gets to the philosophy of it being a free market system for education. So to sign up as a vendor in the ESA system does not require, will require shockingly little. It took me 18 minutes to do it. You do not need to pass a fingerprint clearance like you would for any public teaching school, any state in the country. And once you're cleared as a vendor, you can start advertising your services to families. So I advertise my services to a few micro schools, which are schools that have roughly 30 students. Most of them are unaccredited. And one micro school in the West Valley of Phoenix was interested in having me come teach. And so I had a class of 8 students. They were ranged in age from 12 to 17. And I wanted to teach them a book that was not in their curriculum. Now, this was a Christian micro school, an evangelical Christian micro school. And their curriculum was, as you can imagine, very different from a traditional public school curriculum. So I wanted to teach a book that was kind of a quintessential book in American public schools. So I taught To Kill a Mockingbird. And as it happened, it ended up being kind of the perfect text, because that book has a lot to do with school, has a lot to do with families who are afraid of interacting with families who are different from them. It has a lot to do with a student, Scout, the main character, who is ahead of her peers and feels held back in school. So it ended up being a very rich text to meditate on for the class.
Tell us a little bit about what the insights of those students brought to the book that you found interesting. I don't want to give away everything in the article, because I do want to send people to Harper's Magazine to read the full piece, but just a hint at that experience that you had with those students, because it's quite revealing.
Yes. I think the most revealing thing to me was when we started talking about segregation in school, because of course, To Kill a Mockingbird, the central plot of the book, is about the trial of a Black man who's accused of raping a white woman in the town, and he receives a very unfair trial an unjust verdict. And over the course of talking about that book, one of my students asked, are we talking about systemic racism? And in the piece I mentioned, this was the only time the whole summer when the room got very tense, because suddenly a buzzword had been introduced that was a buzzword that is kind of, in a way, key to the ESA movement. A lot of families who participate in it see it as a way for pulling their kids out of classrooms that would talk about things like systemic racism, right? And it was fascinating to talk with the students about it, because they had very sophisticated thoughts. Their thoughts were not just mirror images of what you would hear on a conservative talk radio about why systemic racism is real or not real. And it was revealing to hear the kids then think about segregation and think about a system and that posits itself as being separate but equal. And I hope to draw readers, I hope to make this illusion for readers that in a way ESA is trying to do exactly that. It's saying, well, we can silo off students in different religious, you know, groupings or different socioeconomic groupings, so long as the state's just giving them an equal share, right? Every kid in the program gets at least this amount of money. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting to hear the students talk about segregation and hearing between the lines of what they were saying, their thoughts on the program, the education program that they were participating in.
Yeah.
Hope that makes sense.
It does. Yeah. You have some experience as a student too, being the kid. Did I understand that correctly in the article, that you're the kids who brought the kid who brought the Bible to school for sustained reading time and was told not here?
Yes, that's right. I grew up evangelical Christian, but I went to public schools, and there's a student in the class that I teach who I saw a lot of myself in, my younger self in. And she talks about how she so yearns to have a different perspective and to be in a school with more students who have different perspectives from the one that she grew up with. Mm. But at the same time, she holds her faith very close to heart. And so, yeah, it was a way I was able to connect with the students, I think. I told an anecdote about having brought a Bible to free reading period when I was in elementary school, and a teacher telling me I wasn't allowed to do that. And I don't hold this grievance very close to heart, but it those things do happen to kids, and families take them very seriously. And you know, it's individual instances like that that I think have built that build up over time, and lead to that sort of moral philosophy we were talking about of the moral justification for the program.
And that brings us back to the beginning of the conversation, something I wanted to follow up on, which was this idea of parental choice. But the vulnerability of this program, I think you talked about the strengths of some micro schools, but one of the vulnerabilities is rigor, accountability, and really imagining what the future for the student might be. Maybe the student isn't getting everything that they might want out of it. Say more about that as we close here, of the vulnerability of these schools.
Yeah. Well, right now there are some very basic vulnerabilities. You know, it's ridiculous that the program doesn't mandate fingerprint clearance for offenders. That's just an obvious thing for keeping kids safe. In Arizona, there is no requirement for kids to take a standardized test or a norm reference test so that the state can judge at a minimum their academic progress. That feels totally irresponsible to me, you know, for a program that's being paid for by taxpayer funds. So that's a huge limitation. We can't know what the kids are learning nor how they're progressing in their education. One of the other big limitations is in a universal program, this sort of voucher system is taken advantage of by high-income families who use it to pay for private school tuition that they previously were not struggling to afford in the first place. And so you end up subsidizing a lot of upper-class elite private education, which feels ridiculous. And there is a limitation too of these schools not needing to be accredited. And so teachers are perhaps not as qualified as they could be, but certainly won't be as qualified as public school teachers. The advantages of the program, which I try to speak about honestly, are that they provide the conditions for small schools. And as most, I think most teachers would agree that we know that what helps students most, no matter their how they learn, is a lot of individualized support, a lot of individualized attention. And at a time when classrooms, public school classrooms are huge, you know, getting up, it's not uncommon to have 30 students in a classroom. At a time when it's become really hard to control technology in the classroom, when student mental health is a huge issue, it's really hard to see a school where kids are happy and are very safe and are able to learn in a way that is largely absent of having technology being dependent in the classroom, and say that that sort of thing is wholly wrong, that whatever is funding this is without any merit. That was the thing I wrestled with most, and I hope readers will wrestle with after reading the piece.
Yeah, it's an excellent piece. Again, the program in South Dakota was very different, but because this is something we're talking about year after year, really insightful to read what's happening in Arizona. The piece is called The Homemade Scholar, A New Frontier in American Education. The author and our guest today, Chandler Fritz. We'll put a link up on our website so people can find your work and find the piece in Harper's. And thank you so much. We hope to talk to you again in the future.
Thank you, Lori. Really appreciate it.
More in the moment is after the break. Teacher Talk on Brain Science here on Listener Supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Recent research and knowledge of how the brain processes has expanded, changing the way we help students learn. Current research is showing that rigor is not defined by more memorization and understanding, but by deeper analysis, evaluation, and creation. We'll dive into why brain science matters for classroom learning on Teacher Talk. Gina Benz is a high school teacher at Roosevelt in Sioux Falls. She's also an adjunct professor at the University of Sioux Falls and the University of South Dakota. She has been teaching for more than 25 years. Jackie Wilbur is a faculty member and director of the Center of Student and Professional Services at the University of South Dakota's School of Education.
It is really fascinating to think about how our brain is structured and how it works and how that connects to the decisions we make every day as teachers. We really do need to know the brain science to be at our very best. And this really got me interested because this summer I was teaching a grad class at USF, and the book we read was talking a lot about brain science. And so I got a little bit obsessed.
And Jackie, this is an area of research for you as well.
Yes, I'm brain scientists would not say so, but from the education standpoint, yeah, right. I would definitely say so. I got interested in it when I was working on my dissertation. There's just a lot of relationships between the stress response and brain science. So that's where my area of research and interest is at.
And I found this so fascinating, and it was one of those moments every once in a while we'll have like what I consider like a leap in my level of respect for teachers, for educators. And I and this is one of them where all of a sudden I sit in awe of what teaching actually is.
Thank you. Thank you.
We're going to get into more of that because I have some questions.
Good. Bring it on.
You're referencing Zaretta Hammond's work here that is about learning theory and brain science. Tell me a little bit about her, Gina.
She especially wants to make sure that all students are being challenged and that we aren't becoming overly sentimental or, I don't know if I'm saying this right, overly compassionate. I'm not saying we shouldn't be compassionate, but sometimes we can be overly compassionate where we then enable things and we don't require students to meet certain expectations. And so her work is a lot about the safety and the belonging kids need, but also the challenge that they need. And our brains need challenge to grow.
And if you don't encourage rigor or provide that kind of rigor, you're really selling your students short.
I used the word marginalize. And I totally mean that. I feel like you're marginalizing your students. You are giving them fewer options and opportunities in their life.
Yeah. Wow. Jackie, what would you add to that? Just this idea of, you know, if we want people to feel safe and secure in the classroom, we're going to get into some details here. Mm-hmm. But broadly speaking, you are preparing students to learn the next hard thing.
Absolutely. Challenge is key to growth. A very simple analogy is that your brain is a muscle. And so if you don't exercise it, if you don't have it lift weights, it won't get stronger. And so you do need the challenge of learning a new task, learning a new skill in order to flex the muscles of the brain and have it develop and get stronger.
I love that you made that analogy because I am trying to see my classroom as a weight room this year.
Yeah. Love this.
As opposed to an obstacle course.
Okay.
And the obstacle course idea is I've got all these hoops to jump through so I can get the grade I want.
Yeah.
As opposed to we're going to practice, we're going to work out, we're going to grow stronger.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I looked up an interview with Hammond, and one of the things she said is that the brain is a learning machine. You don't have to teach it to learn.
No.
That's what it does. That's what the brain does. But we can help enhance its ability to learn more quickly by improving its information processing. That kind of blew my mind. And it got me thinking back to all the ways I learned how to learn in school. And then, again, thinking about all the ways that has changed in the classroom, probably from when I was in school. So let's talk about some of that. Because, Gina, in this blog post, which has links to some research, and you can find it at sdpb.org/teachertalk. You talk about the teacher's primary role and creating this productive struggle.
I love the term productive struggle.
Yeah.
Sometimes we say the zone of proximal development. Did I say that right, Jackie?
You did.
Good. Mm-hmm. And so the teachers have to find the sweet spot where a student has enough challenge, enough struggle that they will grow, but not so much challenge and struggle that they almost become paralyzed by the challenge. So there's a real science and art to that as teachers. We have to constantly be observing and making sure we're giving the right amount of challenge because let's talk about esteem, self-esteem. Mm-hmm. Self-esteem does not come from, oh, you're so smart.
Yeah.
No, self-esteem comes from having a challenge and meeting that challenge. That's where real self-esteem comes from. And so if we are not giving our students these challenges, we're depriving them of, I think actually her book says, if we don't give them challenges that are appropriate, we deprive them of a dopamine hit.
Yeah.
I don't know, that resonated with me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We get a dopamine hit because when we learn to do hard things, that's a positive brain chemical is released.
There it is. Yeah. It's actual brain science.
Yeah.
And And so I think when we talk about self-esteem, let's remember it has to do with being presented with a challenge and meeting that challenge.
Yeah. Jackie, what would you add to that, that idea of productive struggle? Mm-hmm. How would a new teacher, how would a first-year teacher who's really trying to manage everything that a first-year teacher has to manage consider the idea of productive struggle or the zone of proximal development?
Yeah, I like to see myself in the zone of proximal development while I'm seeing my students there, right? Especially first-year teachers, I think that's a good way to reframe things is that you are doing this too, right?
Yeah.
Carol Dweck, and I know I feel like I'm like her mindset minion, but I'm just really, really fascinated by her work, and she continues to write, and I continue to read about what she's doing. But the brain scans will show that when someone encounters a challenge, they either, if the challenge is too hard or they believe they can't meet the challenge, their brain will shrink in response and less of their neurons will fire, and the brain scan will show that it's not activated, right? And so that's what Gina's talking about. If you give a student more than they can handle, it's like giving them a weight that they can't pick up. They're not actually going to be able to exercise with that, right? They're not going to be able to do anything. Yeah. But when you encounter a challenge that is challenging, but you can grow to meet the challenge, brain scans show that more of the brain is illuminated as they try to expand their knowledge to figure out this new concept or idea. And new neurons will fire as they start to make connections and figure out the new skill.
Yeah. You mentioned in here that you have to point this out. Explicitly communicate the rewards that will come from learning and growth for the day. Gina, tell me about that. In what ways in a classroom do you explicitly communicate the rewards?
Okay. I say why we're doing what we're doing.
Okay.
One time, my principal was in the room evaluating me, observing me, and the evaluation came back and said, man, I've always thought commas were really boring, but you made me realize that they're pretty important. Because you talk about how just presenting yourself in writing in a professional way can create a favorable impression with the people you're communicating with. And if you present yourself in writing with a lot of errors, that's a negative impression.
Yeah.
And so I say things like, this is important in the workplace. This will be important in college. This will help us when we get to our next unit.
Mm-hmm.
And then the biggest thing is that, especially when we read literature, this will make us better for society and for ourselves.
Yeah. So this is a weird analogy, but when I was in basic training in the Marine Corps, one of the things you have to do is always sit with your, you know, kind of cross legs on the floor, and they would always say left hand, left knee, right hand, right knee. So you would sit down and everybody would sit in the exact same way. And it would get uncomfortable, and you would sit there for a long time, and you get kind of stiff, even at a young age. And one time an older recruit told me, like in the, I don't even remember how, because we had like no contact with anybody else. And she said, you know why you do that? It's because when you go to the rifle range, that's a position you're going to need to be comfortable in it for a long time. And immediately I was like, oh, there's a reward coming. This isn't just so much in boot camp is just dumb stuff, you know, like it's just stuff to prove that you will obey things. So the Marine Corps is nothing like a classroom, except when it is. And that was one of the times when it was like, oh, we're in this physical position because a month from now, we're going to need to be holding a rifle and leaning over in this exact physical position for hours at a time.
That's a perfect
analogy. By the time we got there, it was a piece of cake. You had that position down.
I feel like they were trying to do it in a Karate Kid kind of way.
Yeah.
Where it's like, you've been doing this the whole time. Yeah, exactly. You know what I mean?
Oh, I love that.
I love that. I thought they were just trying to save space. So, like, we all looked the same. We all fit in the room, you know.
Right.
But there was another purpose to it. And it was when somebody explicitly explained to me the purpose that, for me, was like, oh, okay, now I'm on board.
Yeah.
Before, it was just something I resisted.
Yep.
Yeah. Let's talk about it. Like, I don't know. Should we cut that out?
No.
It seems like a weird
No, that's a perfect analogy.
But I don't know that I got that kind of explicit instruction in school very much.
I think there was a time when it was, do as I said.
Memorize this.
Yeah. And it was just like, I'm the teacher. Do what I say. Yeah. I don't need to give you a reason.
Yeah.
the brain needs a reason in order for it to really engage.
It was motivation. It gave me the motivation to participate in the thing because I was like, oh, okay, that's kind of cool.
The alternative is that you are participating due to a threat or a perceived threat.
Right.
And that's when the inner parts of your brain kick in, when you feel threatened and you move into this automatic state where that inner parts of the brain take over and learning can occur then.
Yeah. That's the other 95% of the Marine Corps. Okay. The brain has three layers and all of these layers impact student learning. Let's go through these, Gina, and start with the reptilian region.
This is where all the automatic stuff happens. Mm-hmm. You don't have to think about breathing. You can, which is a pretty cool thing, that we can think about it and control it, but we don't have to. And I remember Jackie taught me that we can be really thankful to our bodies that we have that, where it will take care of us. But if we need it, we can also take control of it. Anyhow,
she's really wise.
She's the best. Just the best.
Thank you.
So anyhow, that's all the automatic stuff. And again, if there's danger or perceived danger, then it's going to take over. And the other parts of the brain are going to shut down so it can take over and keep you safe.
So how do you create classrooms that feel physically, socially, and emotionally safe for all your students?
One thing that I have always tried to keep in mind is that I can't tell someone else what feels safe to them, right? I can't say this is a safe room, believe me, right? Some people have heard that before in that exact way, and it's been very untrue, right? So I think allowing students to have the autonomy and the power to say, I feel unsafe or I will be more comfortable this way. Because as Gina said in her blog, one of the main things that Zaretta Hammond's work is saying is to move from dependence to independence. So if I'm constantly telling a student, this is what safety looks like, and I'm dictating that to them, they may not then develop the independence to be able to recognize safety on their own. And they've had all these different experiences, right, that I most likely haven't had or have had some of. And so they're coming at the world from a different place. So longer-winded answer than I meant to is to just acknowledge that everyone is coming into this room from a different place. Yeah. Safety looks different for all of us, and that acknowledging that piece will help us kind of come up with some shared norms and procedures that's going to work for everyone. And so some classrooms have different classroom norms because if you create them together, the different needs will get met.
Yeah.
Okay. I like that. And then I'll just add to it, the two words I would say that guide my focus on keeping things safe in the classroom is compassion and care. Mm-hmm. And I just show the kids that I care and that I have compassion for who they are. And that's by noticing that they're wearing a Metallica t-shirt and saying, oh my goodness, what's your favorite song? Yeah. Or noticing that they keep wearing a Bears jersey and I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry. You keep losing.
You had a bad Sunday.
Yeah.
Welcome to Monday.
And it's those inroads that are made that show I care, which create stronger connections over time.
And I wonder, I watched this beautiful video of the school district about you and you're in your classroom and you have a large wall that you've talked about on this show before with photographs, all the senior pictures and invites and like all these hundreds and hundreds of students. And you say in the video, like, if you point to a student, I can tell you a story about them. I can tell you something about them. Some names you might, you know, forget the name because there's hundreds of them, but you know them. Is that a way of creating a sense of social safety for the new students who come in? Because even if they don't fit in with their peers, they know this teacher is going to remember them.
Yeah, actually, as Zaretta Hammond says in her book, she spends a little time talking about how you have to think about the environment that you're creating in your classroom.
Yeah.
And as much as possible, it should reflect the students you have. And my grad students were like, oh, I'd been thinking about my classroom and I wanted it to reflect who I was so I could share myself with my students. And so, you know, I love Star Wars and fantasy and I was going to put Star Wars stuff up, which is great. Yeah, that's great. But also the room should reflect the students who are doing the learning in there. So that's part of the purpose of the pictures. It's also a quick way for my students to see this woman is going to care about me, I think, before I can act. It takes time to show that care to all 120 students I have.
So plus you're also communicating you will get to graduation. Mm-hmm. You will get to the, mm-hmm. the, you know, the job, the military career, mm-hmm. the college, the tech school of your choice, because here they all are.
Yeah. Like you will be this person.
You will be this person. Mm-hmm. And this person is a graduate.
Yeah.
Of Roosevelt High School in your case. Yeah. I love that.
Jackie? Gina, I do want to just add to what you're saying. It's not as though you are practicing caring for your students. You are caring for your students.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I think that's something that, I will just hear people say, well, I asked them about their Metallica shirt. Well, did you actually care about it? You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Yeah. Because if you just, they can smell that inauthentic behavior from a long way away. And so it's not enough to show care. You need to actually care about them, which you do.
I do. I just love people's stories. English mm-hmm. teacher. And so I think it comes naturally. I just kind of want to delve in to hear what the stories are. How did you get interested in Metallica? You were born in 2007.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So we talked about the reptilian region and now the limbic region. What is that?
This is where we process things. Mm. We can process emotions. We can hold memories. And it also, like the reptilian part, is essential for survival because you have to be able to interpret the things that you're seeing. And so it moves a little bit beyond that automatic response, but it's not yet the learning area of the brain.
So is this the part where Zaretta Hammett is saying, you know, everybody comes in with a culture. They come in with context.
Yeah.
They come in with an experience. They come in with memories.
You got it.
Right? So like if you've, you know, I just remember field trips in kindergarten at my daughter's school, and like they went to the breadsmith and watched them make bread. Mm. And that was a way to like help them understand where food comes from, because not all of them had ever had an experience. Like maybe they didn't know where bread comes from, because you just get it from the local grocery store and it's wrapped up in a plastic bag. Mm-hmm. So if all those students come to first grade and they know where bread comes from because they all went on the same field trip, you have created a culture in the school, right? Am I getting it?
It is a little bit more related to genetics. It has some, these traits in the limbic system can be passed down because it is also related to survival. So this is like the idea that culturally for generations, X happened. And so you might have like a sense of something being poisonous because it's a certain color if you live in a certain part of the world. And you maybe wouldn't even need to have been expressly told that, but there is an inherited memory of that in your lineage.
So that's fascinating.
Yes, and that is part
of
it.
It's also essential for survival.
It is also essential for survival. And then on a more present level, if you've had an experience with blank, right, like to continue this poisonous idea, if you ate something that was a certain color and had got an upset stomach, you now carry that memory with you, right? And so as part of your survival going forward, you're suspicious of things that are colored a certain way.
Okay.
And so keeping that in mind as you're interacting with students, sometimes they have a strong reaction to something, right? And you're like, I have no idea where that's coming from. Well, that's because they have these stored memories and emotions in that area of their brain that is helping them stay, you know, helping them with their survival.
Okay, so I'm not going to know that. But how do I respond to it as an educator?
Right, with compassion
and
care.
I can't do a quiz when I come in
and,
you know, get all these little things out of their brain.
Yes.
So then I respond with compassion and care.
Compassion, care, connection. Okay.
100%. Okay. I think that that's also something that when you have all of this knowledge, then you think, oh, I'm going to try to get it all perfect before I have any of these interactions. Well, it's still people, right? So you're still having these like imperfect encounters all the time. And then you can repair them because you care about them. And you say, I didn't mean to upset you in this way, and I am so sorry, and I won't do that again. And what do you need for me to move forward?
And you don't let them free from what the challenge was.
Right.
That you still need to stretch them and help them grow. You might adjust things a little bit, but they still need the challenge.
But it has to be a productive struggle.
Perfect.
I love it. I'm learning. Okay. Neocortex region. Jackie, you want to take this one? The analysis, self-regulation, organization.
Yes.
What's happening here?
Yes. So this is, I've talked before about the stress response. And so when you're in a state of flow or relaxation or ease, this is the part of your brain that's going to be more illuminated, right? This is where you are going to be able to have complex thoughts and to you know, do the actual learning. This is where your brain will live. So the brain scans I was talking about, you're going to be illuminating this part of your brain when you are thinking in complicated ways. And so that's where we're trying to help students put their mindset when they're learning.
And the more we review with students and help and have them repeat things and practice things, the neurons are developing pathways, and those pathways get, we could say, deeper and deeper or clearer and clearer. You know, I think about I'm a country girl. I grew up in the country. I think about a pathway that as more and more cars go over it, it's clearer that there's a pathway there.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Nice.
That is a great analogy. That is how the brain works.
Yeah. Now, I have some questions that that I don't quite know how to answer, so I'm asking you.
We'll
try. So when Zaretta Hammond talks about creating efficiency and learning, like the brain is wired to learn. When you're teaching something, in the interview I saw her, she was talking about like you're teaching a discipline, yes. You know, they need to learn the comma. But what they really need to learn is how to learn the comma, like the ways in which they learn. Help me understand what she means by that.
So with a comma, I think students start out, we call this scaffolding. So you start out at a simpler level and you slowly build on that. Mm-hmm. And so you might start out with that idea of where there's a pause, you might need a comma. Mm-hmm. And then after that, we can build on if you have a conjunction, you might need a comma. And then we can build on it. Well, you need to make sure you have two independent clauses. So we keep building on that. But how do we help them learn how to learn? It's the questioning. Like, do you have two independent clauses? You give them the questions that they should ask themselves.
Okay.
What are the right questions to ask?
Jackie, what would you add to that?
I also think it's similar. Lori, I feel like you tell us frequently how you work best, right? Like, oh, if I'm going to write something, I'm going to go about it this way. And this is why I don't like outlining. I'm just thinking about previous conversations,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Lori is a reverse outliner.
Yes. Yeah. And that is you telling us how you learn best. And so that is what I think Zaretta Hammond is saying, is like that. Knowing that about oneself is key to learning, because you can say, oh, I understand the purpose of outlines, but this is the way that I need to use them in order to optimize the purpose of an outline, right? Mm-hmm. And so something like a comma is a little bit, that's not as complex of a project that a student would be working on,
sure.
Right? This is how this grammatical rule functions. But if I need to study for a test that's going to test me on my knowledge for commas, how am I going to best retain this knowledge? Do I need to read the book again? Do I need to reread my notes? Do I need to go visit with a friend? Do I need to do more practice? And those are the questions that students need to be, and teachers can help them build that skill of how do you learn best.
Yeah. That's Gina Benz and Dr. Jackie Wilbur. There's more to this conversation. You can listen to the full Teacher Talk segment online at SDPB's Teacher Talk podcast. Find it at sdpb.org. or wherever you get your podcasts. Here's one more Teacher Talk update. NPR CEO Catherine Maher was recently on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert, and SDPB got a particular mention. Take a listen.
We know the major NPR shows, they get shared among the stations, and but there are lots of local shows that only address that.
Yes.
I love
this. Oh, what do you got?
Down in South Carolina, I always enjoyed Dr. Walter Edgar's Journal and South Carolina A to Z, like facts about South Carolina. South Dakota Public Radio has Teacher Talk, podcast about teachers talking about their jobs and giving advice to fellow educators. I love Vermont Public Radio's But Why?
I don't know.
That's a program that answers kids' questions.
That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngeman and Ellen Kester. From all of us here at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.